Burn the Boats is proud to support VoteVets, the nation's largest and most impactful progressive veterans organization. To learn more or to join their mission, go to votevets.org. Hi, I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats. Before we start the episode, I want to take a moment to highlight an organization that we talk about in our interview. Together with my daughter, Katie, and a group of local military veterans, we have been supporting the Cleveland Field Office of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants as it works to resettle our Afghan allies arriving in Northeast Ohio, many of whom fled Afghanistan with nothing more than the clothes they were wearing.
I'm Katie Harbaugh, and working with USCRI, I helped coordinate an effort to deliver 90 Thanksgiving meals to Afghan families who just celebrated their first Thanksgiving in America. From the moment a refugee family steps off the plane, USCRI is there to provide them with food, clothing, and safe, secure housing. With your help, USCRI connects refugees to the tools they need to find gainful employment and achieve self-sufficiency. Please visit refugees.org to donate to Ohio's refugee resettlement effort and help our allies build new lives with dignity in the United States.
Thank you, and enjoy the episode.
So at some point, I think you'll, if you trace the history of conservatism in America, it's just a different code each time. And so today's code is CRT. What does that mean? Nothing. It just means we don't want people to learn about the historic racism of our country, which was founded on. And so I do think that Trump's just dressed in a new coat.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Burn the Boats, a podcast about big decisions. On Burn the Boats, I interview political leaders and other history makers about choices they confront when failure is not an option. My guest today is Fred Wellman, senior advisor at the Lincoln Project, which I'm going to assume most of our listeners are familiar with. Fred's resume could fill an entire podcast episode, but his Twitter bio summarizes it pretty well. It reads, West Point, Harvard, and Ranger School, truly educated in Iraq, hashtag welcome them here. Fred, we'll get to all of that. Welcome to Burn the Boats.
That's great to be here. I appreciate it, Ken.
So you started out with Lincoln Project as their veterans guy. Yep. Why was that perspective important to them? And just to give you the context, we love interviewing Republican dissidents on this show. We've had Steve Schmidt, your colleague, and Miles Taylor, and a litany of others. But the veterans' voice has become a pretty powerful one within the within this movement.
Yeah. I started off as a senior advisor. Actually, I'm technically back to being a senior advisor again. But I was a senior advisor for Veterans Affairs starting in July of last year, and it came with a recognition with the founders co-founders of the Lincoln Project that there was a place there for us to influence the election and show that the Trump and the Trump movement, you know, really wasn't supportive of veterans. It wasn't a clear-cut win. You know, we always say traditionally the veteran community and the military community has been conservative and Republican, but you and I know that has been a changing factor in the last 20 years, especially as the new generation of veterans and service members serve for various reasons. And we saw an opportunity to go directly at organizing that community and say, look, you know, there's other options. And so that was pretty much my mission when I started. So we went very directly at that in the campaign. I placed ads in Military Times. We placed ads in Stars and Stripes. People thought we were crazy. But you did see a change in the numbers.
Do you think veterans are in some ways more susceptible to that kind of persuasion given, I don't know how to put it, but there's less of a stovepiping of information in military communities, especially when deployed, than there is in, you know, in some political groupings here stateside?
Well, I think there's a host of good reasons why the veteran community is more appropriate than it used to be, is more available to, you know, talk about the real issues and recognizing the changes in our country. I mean, we do say, you know, swear an oath to the Constitution. And what we've seen in the last, you know, I think 5 years especially has been some very direct attacks on what that oath means. And we've seen some vast politicization of the military in those efforts. So a lot of us have really changed. I mean, you talk about Republican dissidents. I walked away, really the final straw for me was when Trump, you know, said John McCain wasn't a hero. That was Trump. But what bothered me was that so many within the Republican Party were like, eh, okay. And I was like, wait a minute, this is it. And that was a big sign for me because a lot of our fellow veterans, I mean, that would have been a red line for any other candidate in history. Any time in history, if Obama had said something like that or Clinton, my God, it would have been, I mean, fire and brimstone. They would have burned the building down. Instead, we found ourselves in a political time where many in our community were like, eh, well, yeah, he was kind of a bad guy. It was the justification for this sort of authoritarianism, macho-ness that Trump tries to portray. And I knew that I didn't have a home anymore in that party. And so I knew I wasn't alone in that. As I talked to more and more of our peers and more fellow veterans and service members, they were horrified that the values that we swore an oath to and the loyalty we saw to each other was so easily eroded. So I knew we had an opportunity to have that conversation within the community more than we had in the past. And I knew that our opponents in the political spectrum were taking for granted that vote, right? I mean, it's just, they just assumed that no matter what they did, military and veterans would line right up behind the conservative movement. And I think that's not true anymore.
Can you talk about that phony macho-ness that you just called out and why it has such a weird appeal? I mean, you call this out on Twitter sometimes with folks like Josh Hawley and his appeals to manhood. Right. I mean, I'll let you editorialize. I'm not gonna question Josh Hawley's manhood. It's too easy. But why has that become just such an important plank in this new Republican platform, appeals to manhood?
Well, I think you've always, I mean, if you look at the history of authoritarianism, you look at the history of the movements that are more fascist, you know, that dirty word, you know, you do see it's always an appeal to the manliness. It's the strong man, right? They want to see strength. You look at the rise of the movements in Germany. It was in Italy. It was the strong man who was the country was downtrodden. And now we need a strong man. There's always been this sort of fetishization of the macho, the masculine, the manly man. I mean, some people call it toxic masculinity or not. And so you see that so often within authoritarian movements because that's what they look at. Oh, he's a strong man. He's not going to take shit from anybody. And let's be honest, the military is full of very, you know, a lot of those folks, right? I mean, we love it. We love the strong guy. We love the general. We love the great, you know, we venerate our heroes like we as we should. But that when those two paths cross, it could become a toxic and dangerous mixture. And then you see, you know, people like you said, like Josh Mandel or the most ridiculous things. The lady who's running for lieutenant governor of Virginia right now, Sears, she did an ad like with a gun, this hodgepodge weapon she had built for her, I guess. And I'm going to take on the bad guys like I did Semper Fi. It's like she was a Marine like 20 years ago for like 3 years and I think she was logistics tech. It's like, okay, you know, or you see in the last campaign, somebody I went after very hard down in Georgia, who had been a chaplain and was posting pictures of his uniform, how he's going to take on the left. And I was like, you're a chaplain. You didn't even carry a gun, for God's sake. It's like, it's just ridiculous fetishization of military service and ridiculous fetishization of this masculine. It leads to people like Josh Hawley, who's now made, you know, masculinity, you know, his framework. It's like, my God, I mean, you know, you and your tucked in polo at the wine store doesn't scream, you know, Mr. Bad Guy, you know, or how every single ad now starts with a gun it seems like every Republican has to run with an ad at the range or some ridiculous thing. It does go to, because you're exactly the thing, Ken. You're saying to yourself, well, I understand how this is conservative. Well, it's not. It's not conservative. It's authoritarian. And that's where the line, I think, if you take our political framework right now and you draw a straight line through it, it's not necessarily a political party issue, right? It's become tied to a certain political party, but this fetishization of the strongman, the fetishization of victimhood, you know, and how we have to overcome and fight back runs like a bright red line through the Republican Party right now. And so what do we got? We've got a guy who took a gun illegally, crossed state lines, wasn't even allowed to have a gun at 17.
Kyle Rittenhouse,
and he's being venerated as a hero for killing people that he had no right to be there. He had no reason to be there. But that strong man, you know, that night, I literally saw a post today. One of our colleagues in the Marine Corps posted screen grabs of a Marine Corps E9 posting on Facebook about the night of Kenosha and how, you know, how he, the Kyle Rittenhouse mile where you run 638 feet being chased by riders and then gun them down. It's just, it's terrifying is what it is.
Does it depend on Trump? I'll tell you what I mean by that. I mean, right. You're describing a culture of the right. strong man, and a lot of people tie that like inextricably to Trump himself. But I'm wondering if Trump isn't bigger than a single person.
Well, I think that's the thing we say. That's why we use the term the Lincoln Project as Trumpism, right? It is a modern authoritarianism movement that latched onto Trump as the guy. And that's the big question now, is if Trump's going to be the leader of that movement, or is that movement able to be picked up by somebody else? I do think that's why you see Josh Hawley talking about masculinity. You see, you know, pear-shaped, you know, Josh Mandel, wanting violence for our Judeo-Christian, you know, there is this great effort by people who have no right to have any sort of masculinity, argument fighting for that mantle. And so I guess that is the question. I think too many people thought, and it does get us to where we are today, I think too many people thought that with the departure of Trump from the White House, that everything was going to be okay. We're going to go back to normal. It's something I say a lot if you follow me. The desire to go back to normal. Oh, now Trump's gone. We can go back to normal. Like, no, we can't. That the movement that encouraged Trump and the January 6th events that occurred show us that there is a great desire for more of that movement, and that what we've seen is just the beginning of it. January 6th was a practice run, and we have to treat it as such.
I've heard former President Trump described as the consummate follower, that he has his finger on the pulse of where his most radical, I shouldn't call them followers because their followers come leaders, right?
Yeah.
Where they want to go. And he was able to pick up on that before anyone else. And now you have a major American political party that is terrified of its own mob.
Yep.
Which it feeds, and it becomes a vicious cycle, which suggests to me that that it endures post Trump.
Yes,
is that
absolutely
the Lincoln Project's assessment when you talk about defeating not just Trump but Trumpism?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That the GOP as a whole, that the Republican Party as a whole, has given in to their base instincts. If you saw one of our most recent ads, we talked about the Southern strategy of Lee Atwater. And, you know, and people beat us up. It's funny how many people beat us up, because many of my co-founders, my bosses there, were part of that movement. Yeah, exactly. We were. Stuart Stevens literally wrote a book called It Was All a Lie. I mean, there's no question in my mind that my bosses there at the Lincoln Project don't understand their role in all of this. So it's kind of funny when you see people attacking him for, I love it. Hell, I get beat up for, I think my favorite one is the right-wing nut job, especially the veteran nut jobs. Love to post pictures, the screen grabs of me criticizing Joe Biden back in 2012. It's like, yeah, I was a Republican then. So anyway, you caught me. And so what we realize is that the Republican Party, there was always this appeal that it was the Southern strategy back in the day. There was always a dog whistle, sort of a head nod to the baser elements of racism, the baser elements of, you know, the fear of socialism, right? All those things in the past. So there was always that element. And then at the growth of the social conservatives, the growth of the religious right conservatives within the movement, very much encouraged all the way back to Ronald Reagan, has grown to a point where there is no longer a Reagan Republican. I talk about it quite a bit, that the Republican Party is almost in three ways now. There's the Reagan Republicans who still are trying desperately to hold on to what was party. And that's your McConnell's per se and others, but it's still about power. You got your Trumpist, right? And then those are the guys who really love the manly man, how we're going to take our country back, make America great. And now you even got this third element, which is even scarier, which is I call them the January 6th insurrectionist, where not only they're ready to act on it, and there's a large swath. There's recent polls showing that something like a third of Republicans believe that violence will be necessary to take over the country or to lead the country. So we've got a fate. We're in a very dangerous place in America today, where a large portion of a major America party believes that violence is a part of the political spectrum and should be, and constantly have this weird fetishism for like a new civil war, which is hilarious because they forget that many of us on the air side also have guns. So good luck with that. But it's just, it is a very scary movement. So we at the Lincoln Project have recognized, I think for us, we always knew that it would not die with Trump. We talked about it before the election, even if we won. But I think January 6th made it extremely clear to everyone at the Lincoln Project that we were far from over, and in many ways we're just starting. And that is why we can't slow down. You can't take your foot off the gas.
This is Alex Hastie, the host of Ohio vs. the World, an American history podcast. On Ohio vs. the World, we'll travel back in time with the authors, historians, and even witnesses to visit the most exciting, consequential, and too often overlooked topics that have shaped America's history. There seems to be an Ohio connection to so many important moments.
When you said Ohio versus the world, we did some damage.
So join us and we'll take a deep dive to enlighten, educate, and entertain you as Ohio versus the world makes history fun again.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having a lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
I'd love your perspective on this as a former Republican who spends most of your professional daylight hours with fellow former Republicans.
Yeah.
Is that appeal to authoritarianism, that hearkening back to better times, is it simply in the nature of conservatism, its definitional appeal to a status quo and and the fear of disrupting power structures that benefited for generations, those at the top? I mean, is it conservatism itself that is part of the problem?
Always, without question. I mean, let's be honest. It was always the issue, right? It was always about conserving a status quo, conserving a power structure based on, and let's be honest, in America, it's been based on, in many ways, a white power structure, a financial structure that allows, very rich white people to stay in power. And so it really has only just gone through threads. I read a fascinating article today in the Post about, the analysis of the Virginia campaign today. And how this whole CRT thing, that Glenn Youngkin's trying to pile onto, has traces its route. It's right back to the Daughters of the American, Daughters of the Civil Confederacy. There's always been this line drawn between maintaining the power structures that they liked. I mean, that's why I laugh when people go, "Oh God, Republicans today, everything is socialism." I'm like, dude, you don't have to look far for that. It's always been that way. Social Security was called socialism. I mean, the New Deal was socialism. The federal highway system was called socialism back in the day by, quote, conservatives, right? Yeah, anything that had to do with allowing, larger access to our economy, larger access to our society by those who weren't deemed the correct people at that moment. And it's easy to forget. It wasn't always just white people. It was also the right white people. I'm Italian. I'm half English and half Italian. My English side came over in 1640. My Italian side came over in the early 1900s. We were forced into bad parts of town as Italians, right? So the Catholics, it's easy to forget that when John F. Kennedy ran for office, he had to convince a large swath of America that a Catholic could be president. And you don't get much whiter than John Kennedy, okay? So there's always been this long line of a very specific conservative movement to maintain a certain power structure. And I think in many ways, it's just a different code every time, right? I mean, what we've seen is, and I bought into it, I was a defense, I used to call myself a defense hawk, a conservative defense hawk. I was a fiscal conservative, right? And in many ways, I still am. But I now realize that just means I just don't want people wasting my damn tax money on stupid stuff. And I don't want to be weak as a nation. I want us to be sure we can win our wars when we fight them. But 20 years of war taught me we don't need to be at war all the freaking time. And so at some point, I think if you trace the history of conservatism in America, it's just a different code each time. And so today's code is CRT. What does that mean? Nothing. It just means we don't want people learning about the historic racism of our country, which was founded on. And so I do think that Trump's just dressed in a new coat.
I think this is a good segue into your Twitter bio, hashtag welcome them here.
Yes.
Why is that important enough to you to put at the very top of your bio. I think I know what it's about, but why don't you?
Yeah,
don't
you explain? It's about our Afghan allies. It's about all of them. You know, I fought for many years for our interpreters and others who had the opportunities to come here, and then it was constantly being battled. I was a mentor for No One Left Behind, Matt Zeller, who's now at who now just got a job at Iraq, Afghanistan, Veterans of America, as a matter of fact. But the idea that we should, those who fought with our by our side should be welcome. But I've also matured to the point where I believe all refugees, we should welcome refugees, we should welcome immigrants. I mean, the ultimate irony right now is that while the same people who are saying they're angry because they can't get takeout from their favorite restaurant because there's not enough employees, don't see the bright red line to Stephen Miller and Donald Trump's complete stifling of refugees and immigrants. You know, we bring our economy to a halt when we stop new people coming in. I'm just a big believer. For the last 3 months since the events in Afghanistan, I've been very passionate about making sure our allies are welcomed and already seeing the racism. You just have to look last weekend, this ridiculous, which it turns out to be completely false, terrorist warning of ISIS, an ISIS sleeper cell, which was twisted into, one, by the way, it was fake. Two, it was being twisted by conservative commentators into, because we have Afghan refugees in Northern Virginia. So is now our Afghan allies are apparently, you know, terrorists. It's just this constant battle to convince people. And where does it start for me? 2004, 4 months after I left Iraq, my first interpreter, Bassam Yusuf Sabri, was murdered, beheaded by al-Qaeda because he was an interpreter for the United States forces. I spent the next 9 months working with a wonderful team of smarter people than me who managed to extract his wife, his widow, and his kids out of Iraq and get them settled in the United States, where now his widow is an American citizen. And so we owe them a debt of gratitude and a debt of their lives to protect them. So I watched in horror as the events in Afghanistan unfolded. Having never served in Afghanistan, I didn't participate. I couldn't be one of the guys who was like guiding people at the airport. I had no business. I one thing I've learned over the years is I try to stay in my lane, right? I'll do anything people ask me to, but you know, if I don't know what I'm doing, I try to stay out of it. And there were smarter people than me on that job, but I could welcome them here. So I did what I do, which is I found our local refugee settlement organization and volunteered. So that's what I ask of people.
Can you talk about that just as a plug? We've got USCRI here in Cleveland, which is doing an incredible job. Which one are you supporting?
International Institute of St. Louis is the local settlement organization here in St. Louis. They handle refugee resettlement in St. Louis and then about a 100-mile circle around St. Louis. So they plug right into the U.S. government. They're expecting somewhere around 1,600 probably Afghans from this movement right now. So, and the amazing thing, that the gratifying thing is what I've done for them in the past year now is help them with the just overwhelming number of donations they got from the people of St. Louis. At one point, cars were literally circling the block around the facility because they're dropping off so much stuff for our Afghan allies. So, I always tell people, look, people come to me all the time, say, what can I do? How can I help? Well, start local. You know, Google refugee resettlement in your city. Those, you know, and believe it or not, it'll come, like you said, SCRI in yours, or it could be the Catholic Charities, it could be Lutheran Services. There's a number of organizations across the country in each city, and they're all handled locally. So start local.
Yep. Well, we dropped off food and diapers and baby crib and a bunch of stuff just last night. One more plug before we get back to our topic. Housing is just such a critical bottleneck right now, in Cleveland, and I'm sure everywhere. Hats off to Airbnb for providing a bit of a stopgap for some of these families, but you're talking tens of thousands trying to get out of the camps, and we just don't have the housing for them. No. So if you've got spare room, reach out.
Or a house. It's been gratifying here in St. Louis to see this incredible coalition come together between the city and their local representatives and the various housing authorities, the various business authorities, business organizations have all been coming together to create opportunities with housing and upgrading. And then plugs to our core partner. What I've been seeing gratifying too, Ken, is those organizations that I've worked with for years in my previous job at ScoutComs, my firm that focused on veterans, you know, Starbucks, Home Depot, companies have been stepping up. Starbucks is reaching out saying, hey, we want to try to get these guys jobs. So it's really been gratifying to see the close parallels between those who serve veterans and those who want to serve our Afghan allies as they come over. It's been really gratifying to see them step up to the plate.
Awesome. Are you a dog person, Fred?
I am.
Do I hear a dog drinking from the water bowl right now?
Yes, I apologize. Yes.
Don't.
River came over to check out what's going on over here. At some point, my cat will walk across the screen as well. It's a...
We're animal people too, so it's all good.
It is.
Yes. I want to get back to the Lincoln Project. You have an MO that really sets you apart. And this part of the conversation is going to be about the role, frankly, of anger in politics, but I want to read how James Carville described the Lincoln Project. And man, I wish I had it in his voice. I'm not going to try to recreate it, but he said, "Let me tell you, the Lincoln Group and the Bulwark, these never-Trumper Republicans, the Democrats could learn a lot from them. They're mean. They fight hard, and we don't fight like that." Well, where does that come from? Is that also in the nature of being historically Republican? Do you just have that mean streak?
Well, I it's funny being a black hat guy in a white hat world. It was really unusual for me when I joined I remember when I joined the Lincoln Project, one of my first meetings, I said, "Well, what are our policies?" Like, "Oh, we don't do policies. We're just trying to win elections." I'm like, "Huh." And the one thing I've learned that Republicans do really well compared to our Democratic colleagues is the focus on winning elections. Look, your great policy and your huge plan is great, but if you don't win the election, it's moot, right? And too often, the Democrats are looking past the election to the big policy, right? And too often, as you know, they're happy to lose an election for the right reasons, right? and there's a fundamental lack of understanding. Some people call it a purity test a lot on the left that is infuriating, which is a whole separate topic. But the thing about us as being the Lincoln Project, we recognized early on that the choice was decent versus indecent. It was authoritarian versus democracy. And I think January 6th made our point clear, right? Is we have an entire party and a political organization dedicated to rolling back our rights as Americans, the very foundations of our voting rights, the very foundations of our ability to access our elected leaders, adding violence to our spectrum. Whereas, again, on our partners in the Democratic Party, seem to want to get back to normal. They want to pass. There's still this belief that they just passed good legislation. I mean, name one piece of legislation that Mitch McConnell passed in all those 4 years under Trump. The tax cut. That's it. They're not trying to do big things, but yet they keep winning elections, right? And so I think you have to. I think there's what we believe at the Lincoln Project and as former Republicans is, you win the election, then you can pass your policy. You win a lot of elections, you can pass a lot of great policies. And now we're at a point now, even to the point where like win an election or lose our democracy. And so, yeah, we will be cutthroat. We've pulled some stunts. I mean, and the thing about us is I'll be honest, not everything works. Some are bad ideas, some blow up in our face. Some ads have been a disaster. Some stunts have been a disaster recently, we're not perfect. But the thing about us that I've enjoyed, being both a senior advisor and then I was the executive director is that we're willing to take the shot. Right? We don't overthink it. The process is not a long... people would probably be shocked at the process we use within the Lincoln Project to get things done. Let me tell you something. It's not long. Okay? It's just act, go, go, go. I mean, I tell the story often of... in my experience, we were days from the election. It was a Friday before the election. I had pretty much done all the organizing I could do at that point, right? And so I got the idea... we saw Trump saying that he only wanted votes counted on November 3rd. He didn't want any, after that, it should be cut off, right? Well, those are absentee ballots. You and I know that most military ballots arrive after the election day very often, that many of the absentee ballots don't make it from overseas. With the Postal Service slowdowns that he managed to implement, there are even more absentee ballots. So what I heard very clearly was we're going to disenfranchise military voters. So I went to my leadership. I said, "Hey, I'd like to do an ad with a celebrity highlighting the fact that absentee ballots are mostly military." And literally, Reed Gayle's like, "Great, I love it. Go." Okay. Have I written at many? At that point, I've written a couple of ads. I wrote one for the Vimmons. I wrote one for Sully Sullenberger. I helped write one. But I was like, okay. And literally within 8 hours, I'd recruited Mark Hamill. I'd gotten our videographers up and running. I'd helped write a script. I actually written a script. Gotten it to Mark Hamill over the weekend. Saturday, he cut his tape. Saturday night, it was in edits. By Sunday, I had my ad. And we issued it, about 48 hours for the election. that's how kind of our process is very simple. It's get things done, throw it against the wall, everything, you know, see what works. So that's very different. You didn't hear a focus group, did you? You didn't hear, you didn't hear a poll, right? You didn't hear A and B, beta testing. No, we just go, which is fun.
But as you said, it does lead occasionally to some some backfiring attempts. How do you respond to that criticism that your shoot first, aim later approach, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm putting words in your mouth, that it adds to the vicious cycle. And, you know, I gotta call out the tiki torches stunt, how do you respond to the criticism that your appeal to anger and fear is just part of this larger vortex that's damaging our politics?
Well, I would say that people should be angry about the fact that Glenn Youngkin was in Charlottesville during the trial, the civil trial against those who organized that event, and still refused to condemn it. And that was the point of that trick. Was it perfect? I didn't put that one together, but it is what it is. But the point was very clear that the Republicans are madder about the stunt than they are about the fact that 5 years ago, or 4 years ago, there was a mass march of white supremacists carrying tiki torches saying Jews will not replace us. And the Republican candidate for governor refuses to condemn that, refuses to condemn the guy who thought there was good friends. My frustration with my friends on the Democratic side is they're more worried about that than they are about the actual fight. They're more worried about fact. They're afraid to be angry. It's like, it's a strange thing. It's like, it's okay to be angry, because you know why Republicans show up to vote is because they're fighting. They're fighting. They believe they're fighting for the whole soul of our country. And too often, I think my peers on the Democratic side are just want to freaking hug it out or something. I have no problem with appealing to people's anger and their emotions, because if you want to know how Republicans win elections, that's why. Just watch the video that came out yesterday from the Good Liars, whom I love, just love. They have a movie coming out with our friends at the Midas Touch called the Believers. But just look at the gentleman who's a retired Air Force guy wearing an Air Force hat, saying that the most important issue for him in this election, Virginia, is critical race theory, teaching critical race theory. And the guy's like, but they don't teach it. He goes, what is it? What is critical race theory? They go, I don't know what it is, but I'm against it. He literally has no effing idea what he's talking about. He has no idea that CRT isn't taught in any school in Virginia. But what they've done successfully on the right is painted any kind of teaching of history that's uncomfortable for white people. The lady on the circus the other day that was interviewed literally said that teaching about slavery makes white kids feel guilty about being white, and she doesn't like that. That's not up to the schools to teach that. It's like, that's what they're angry about. That's what they're going to the polls to stop. And so no amount of us saying, yeah, but what about our policy? We're going to try and get a child tax credit. They just don't get it, that people do emotion. Look, I took a class from Mark McKinnon in grad school. Mark is, of course, now the host of the circus on Showtime, but he's a famous ad maker for the Republicans before that. And Mark taught a great story. And the point was that storytelling hasn't changed from the caveman days, that a story, there's the hero's journey. That's what, the chief of the tribe in the cave would get up and say, our spears, the most powerful ones in the valley. We have slayed the Mastodon. We've slayed our enemies, Oh, great story. He's not talking about, look, my policy for us is that everybody should have one fire and it'd be equal amongst us. No. And I think from the day we were cavemen, we have to understand that there is an emotional aspect to our lives as human beings that has to be tapped into. And too often my Democratic colleagues are like, yeah, but great policy. It's like, no, you're fighting for the life. And right now, again, I have no patience for these. I mean, I look, criticize us all day. I have no problem with that. But I also have no patience for the idea that we shouldn't be doing these things. We shouldn't be going after them every time we can. You take your shot. It's just no different than military, right? You're going to take a shot, even if it just keeps their head down. Maybe you won't land every bullet you send, but maybe you'll just suppress them a little bit. I'm comfortable with that. And so we make a lot of people uncomfortable because we're willing to take some shots and put heads down instead of overthinking every piece of what we do and going through motions. But I honestly, my frustration right now with our politics is too many people are just not passionate. You should be angry that our capital was invaded. You should be angry that the guy running for governor in Virginia is saying one thing on right-wing media. He's going on Seb Gorka's show. He's going on Mark Levin's show. He's going on F and Steve Bannon's show, saying one thing, and then going on regular media and speeches saying a completely different thing. And those of us who highlight that are told, well, you shouldn't be echoing Steve Bannon. Like, I'm not. I'm trying to get you to wake up. And it's just this belief that if they put their head in the sand, that it will go away, and that doesn't work. You know, evil doesn't go away just because you don't like it. You want to ignore it. The enemy gets a vote, and so I just as a long answer to a short question, but I guess it took me a little while to get comfortable, but I'm willing to be the guy that gets beat up for the right reasons.
I think it's obvious to those listening that we're talking on Election Day in Virginia and around the country, but all eyes are on the Virginia gubernatorial. This is going to come out, after we know who won.
Right.
But it has become clear that part of the Republican playbook in the run-up to these elections is laying the groundwork to claim it was stolen.
Yes, already.
And that is new.
Yes.
I mean, you can point to a lot of things that we're upset about in our politics today that we've seen before. But the idea that we're not going to accept the results of an election and the fact that that idea has taken root within, at this point, a majority of Republicans who voted for Donald Trump, that is new. And that is really an existential threat.
It is. It is. I just this morning, I was looking at it was a tweet from a tweet from one of the right wing guys, Eric Erickson, and literally every reply he was showing his poll showing that Youngkin's up by 2 points, and literally every response was, you don't think the Democrats will allow that? They're going to steal it. They're going to stop it. It's like this ridiculous belief that somehow elections are easy to steal or they're commonly stolen is become such a, again, the Walter Schaub, who I love dearly, the former government ethics lawyer, has been really, really hitting President Biden hard. And his criticism, and it's hard to disagree, is that, you know, Biden's only given one speech on voting rights. I like the Build Back Better plan. I like all of it. But all this is moot. Every single one of these spending packages and programs can be turned back, you know, in a heartbeat if we can't get people to vote. My colleagues at the Lincoln Project really say it well. Steve Schmidt, which you said you interviewed before, you know, Steve and Reed talk about a lot is, in many ways, the Republican Party right now, in the form that it's in now, is like a shrinking star. It's like a dying star. It's shrinking. It's getting smaller. You know, the minority rule is what they need as the majority of their voters shrinks, essentially. But if you know anything about astrophysics, you know that as a star shrinks, it gets hotter, more radioactive, and more dangerous till it freaking explodes. And I think a lot of people kind of fooled themselves into believing that perhaps that explosion was January 6th. And I'm here to tell you, that was nothing. That was a solar flare. You know, what scares me is as their party desperately holds onto power, as they undermine our democratic institutions unfettered, it could lead to an explosion that nobody dreamed could possibly happen in America. But then again, none of our founding fathers dreamed a president like Donald Trump, who simply just didn't care about norms and traditions and ignored them. It really showed how many of our institutions were unprepared for this moment.
Get specific for us. What's the worst case scenario? What do you really mean when you say a political supernova?
Well, I mean, violence, obviously, a larger violence, a large scale violence, violence at state houses across the country, murders, coordinated assaults on our democracy. Maybe the next assault on Congress is more successful. In a subtle framework, it's simply throwing out elections they don't like. In theory, the Georgia legislature could just throw out an election. Well, sorry, it's tainted. We're getting rid of the election people. We're going to take it. I mean, literally the ability to throw out election results they don't like is what many of these people are pushing for, like in Arizona and elsewhere. They're literally trying to make it so that the Republican legislature can simply say, well, no, obviously we have our doubts. We're not going to take that election. We're going to throw it out until they get the results they want. Literally, voting would be meaningless in our country. But for me, I do have great fear of actual violence. I don't people are paying attention to what happened on January 6th. I don't think they're paying attention to the growing movement of those who say, well, I think violence is the answer. I mean, you can't ignore the people. At what point do you have to take it serious when people, when you listen, when they're saying they're going to shoot Joe Biden, when they say they're going to, at what point do you take them seriously and somebody's going to do it? I just don't recall this level of threats. And what bothers me the most is just how many people just want to ignore it, like it isn't real. It's just talk, is it? Because there was a lot of you read this Washington Post series right now about January 6th, and you should be horrified because there was a billion red flags going off, and it was ignored because people just like couldn't believe it. And I'm just seeing a lot of us are out here saying, believe it. You have to believe it. I know it sounds outrageous that the American democracy could die in violence, but why would that be outrageous? It has happened throughout history. Why are we any different? Why are we so much more immune to it than anyone else throughout history has been? If you believe that we're that special, that we're immune to that, I think you're going to be January 6th should dissuade you of that notion in every way possible.
How do you divide the moral culpability for all of this? Of course, you've got the foot soldiers, the agitators, the ones who actually stormed the Capitol, and they need to be held accountable. The FBI has to do what it's got to do. But then there are those who held back, who know where the legal lines are, who fist pump them on. I've got to think that you have considered how to lay blame fairly between those who actually carried the flagpoles and beat the cops and those who stood back and cheered them on, but with language that they could disavow if they had to.
100%. I mean, they've gotten very good at that. You know, a lot of these guys, that's how they've managed to make it this far. They've managed to say, well, I had, you know, keep their fingerprints off of it. But you have to believe, you know, at what point do we say that this was encouraging violence, this is inciting sedition. You know, we just found out yesterday, Marjorie Taylor Greene spent $25,000 for ads on Parler encouraging people to come to the January 6th rallies. Okay, well, where does a person who just got seated in Congress like 3 days before that event find that money and put that? You know, it's like there's real questions that had to be asked of those who organized these events and the delusions that they had nothing to do with the violence. I mean, the violence was encouraged. I am frustrated by the pace of the investigations, but I'm hopeful. I know Deborah Riggleman, who's now working for the January 6th committee. I know a few of the folks involved in that. I have faith that they understand the stakes that are in play here. But at what point do we recognize that the organizers and those who encourage it? And then what's disheartening is the media, the propagandists. I mean, you know, we now see Fox in a full-on effort to convince us the whole thing was fake. I mean, we've really got a very dangerous situation in America. There's so many institutions that should be scary. Our political press is failing us in every possible way right now in their inability to avoid the both-sidism. You know, our institutions like our government ethics watchdogs are completely failing us because they have no idea how to deal with the things we're seeing and the rules that we have in place are not being adjusted. Our electoral system is failing us because it can be manipulated by legislatures now. You know, I think so many pieces of the puzzle that built this country and made it great were situated on people of good character and moral being the people in power. And we were unprepared for a moment where people who just want raw power and care nothing for the rules, whose sole functionality in life is to find holes in the rules, are still in power. I mean, look at Kellyanne Conway. Look, Kellyanne Conway broke the Hatch Act like 60, 70 times. Nothing happened. You know, nothing, because the system was designed that her boss would be mad about that. Her boss like, great, go for it. They don't care. And so I think a lot of us get nervous when we realize that so much of our country was built on infrastructure and institutions that were never prepared for the modern world, never prepared for social media, never prepared for media ecosystems that are separate from the rest. So I don't know. Maybe I sound like I'm freaking out, but that's possibly I am. and for a guy like in my position in the work I've done when I was the executive director of Lincoln Project, especially when we had our own crisis, the death threats, the kind of violent rhetoric that's thrown at us, it makes you really think, at what point does someone actually take it seriously? You know, at what point does someone say, you know what, everybody forgets the whole QAnon thing started with the whole pizza, you know, the guy showing up at Comet Ping Pong Pizza and shooting up a pizza shop because Hillary Clinton had kids in the basement of a restaurant that didn't have a basement. It's a miracle to me that more of those haven't occurred, but I do believe that day of reckoning may come sooner than we like.
Do you have any insight into what the provocateurs are thinking? Like, what's their, and I'm talking about the ones who know better, the Josh yeah. Hawleys, the Josh Mandels, yeah. You know, two fellow Yale law grads. Like,
yeah.
Where do they think this ends, the house they're setting on fire is still the house they live in, you know, driving out the responsible voices like Kinzinger and Gonzalez. I mean, they're going to wind up in a party that is so extreme, it's going to destroy the country.
I honestly believe that most of these guys think they can control it, that it's they've got this under control, that they don't understand the forces they're unleashing. I honestly believe that there's this delusion that they can control it and they can take charge and it won't blow up in their face too. But you know how it is, when a raging wildfire gets lit, it burns everything. And I think too many of them want the power, they're just... I mean, you look at Eric Greitens, you look at Josh Mandel, J.D. Vance. Why is J.D. Vance running at all? You know, why is Peter Thiel buying an election? You know, it's this lust for power, and they're willing to do whatever it takes. You know, and Josh Hawley seems to have no morals. It's interesting being in Missouri now, because we're watching the Republican contest. You got Josh Hawley as a senator, but now you got Eric Greitens running. You've got Eric Schmidt, who's the attorney general, who's basically spent the last year and a half using the power of his office to propel his Senate campaign by suing school districts for mask mandates, by participating in the lawsuits for, you know, the border. Like, Missouri doesn't have a border with Mexico. Why are we, it's just these men, and mostly men, have forsaken the most basic instincts of appropriateness and the good of our country for power. I mean, I used to really think that was crazy, but they just want to be in the seat of power. Sadly, I think the side of it is too, that too many of Americans just don't even know what they should expect anymore. I think there's a large swath of America that thinks that their congressman's job is to just be on Fox News causing fucking trouble. You know, they don't know that those are the guys you're supposed to go to for, you know, getting their kid home from Saudi Arabia deployment when his grandma dies, and helping out, you know, doing the most basic constituent services or being a representative of that organization, of that community. They just think, you know, it's great. Oh my God, he's on Fox News again. This is so good for us. Like, how is it? And how is Marjorie Taylor Greene serving the people of Northern Georgia when she doesn't even sit on any committees? You know, she's not even representing them. She has no power. She just, her big thing is going up and making floor speeches that no one listens to, and going on OAN. She's not a congressman. She's a troll. I'm just going off of the deep end, but it is, yeah, I do believe that a lust for power, and let's be, it's funny, you know, you'll appreciate it, Ken. I was in Iraq in 2003, and I was talking to my local Iraqi sheikh in my villages. I ran civil affairs around Key West, and I never forget. I said, why are these men, you know, why are these kids doing these bombs? And what is he goes, it's simple. Like, I think anywhere, this is an Iraqi who's never left Iraq, money and power. You know, I was like, okay. It literally goes back to what we said about communications earlier. It goes back to the most basic things, money and power. It's just sadly, how often can we trace so many of these individuals from their humble roots to be multimillionaires and a lifetime being called senator or whatever?
Yeah. Well, Fred, you have painted a sobering picture. I hope it's more than that and a wake-up call. Keep doing what you're doing, mostly. Fewer backfires, but really.
Well, I'm a senior advisor now, so I'll caveat everything I said.
Got it.
I don't do strategy at the organization, but I do coalitions and partnerships. But you know, the guys are, you know, again, we'll take a shot. I wish more people would.
Good. We end the show every episode with the same question. What's the bravest decision you've ever been a part of?
The first time Bassam got a death threat and by name, I said, you got to quit. You know, you can't do this. And Bassam's like, no, I can't stop now. You know, I've committed to this. I'm taking care of my family and the good of my country. And then probably 6 months later, he was dead. I've seen, you know, men like Hal Reichel and Mike Daniels, my crew from Desert Storm, who did an intervention for our night vision goggle mission into Iraq during the air war, because I was the lowest rated NVG pilot of our team, even though I was the platoon leader, and said, no, it only needs to be the most senior pilots going into this dangerous environment. And they didn't return. So I've seen a lot. That's a very difficult question to answer, because I've seen very brave men and women make very difficult decisions that sometimes too many times led to their own deaths. So I wish I had a better answer, but I've seen incredibly brave people do incredibly brave things in this life.
Well, thanks, Fred. And for what it's worth, that's why I ask it that way. I find that when I ask veterans the bravest decision they've ever made, they always point to someone else. And so, you know, it's better, I think, to talk about the bravest decision you've ever been a part of. So I appreciate your perspective. Been an honor having you. Let's do it again.
Likewise. I appreciate the time.
You got it. Thanks again to Fred for joining me. You can find him on Twitter at FPWellman. Thanks for listening to Burn the Boats. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. For updates and more, follow us on Twitter at team_Harbaugh. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Thanks to our partner, VoteVets. Their mission is to give a voice to veterans on matters of national security, veterans care, and issues that affect the lives of those who have served. VoteVets is backed by more than 700,000 veterans, family members, and their supporters. To learn more, go to votevets.org. Burn the Boats is a production of Evergreen Podcasts. Our producer is Declan Roars, and Sean Ruhlhoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloya, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Burn the Boats, a podcast about big decisions.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.
This podcast was produced with the support of the Ohio Motion Picture Tax Credit and in partnership with the Ohio Development Services Agency.